This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Earlier this week, NASA scientists were jubilant. After decades of searching for it, they had finally confirmed finding what they had been looking for, liquid water.
Mars is not the dry, arid planet that we thought of in the past. Today, we're going to announce that under certain circumstances, liquid water has been found on Mars.
Now, it is not the first time for water on Mars. There's ice at the poles, water in the air, even snow falling from the sky. But in some ways, finding liquid water, even if just a bit, has already changed the conversation about the red planet. If there's liquid water, could there be life? Could people set up habitats on Mars and farm the planet, make rocket fuel out of its nitrogen, oxygen out of its CO2? All fitting discussions for a week when a new film, The Martian, opens in theaters. We'll get to that a little bit later. But so far, such thoughts are still locked up in science fiction. For in a time of limited funding and shifting national priorities, is the conversation changed enough to speed up efforts to send humans to Mars, fund new spaceships, make Mars a higher priority? We're going to be talking about the water and the will this hour. And if you'd like to call us, give us a call. Our number is 844-724-8255, 844-SCI-TALK. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Let me introduce my first guest. James Ray is an assistant professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology in Atlanta. He's one of the authors of a paper on Mars water findings out this week in the journal Nature Geosciences. He joins me from the studios of WABE in Atlanta. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks.
In that clip that we heard, Jim Green, head of the Planetary Sciences Division of NASA, said that under certain circumstances, liquid water has been found. What are those circumstances?
So what we're seeing are these flows that occur on steep slopes when the temperatures are, doesn't have to be above 0 degrees Celsius, the freezing point of pure water, but it has to be warm enough that a salty solution could melt, even if pure ice couldn't. So you have to have sufficient temperature. You have to have some source of water. That's still unknown. And there must be some other things controlling it, because we only see it in a few places, dozens of places, but it's not like this happens everywhere on Mars.
So you need to have the right circumstances. And those dark streaks, Is the water itself?
That's right. So that's what we had suspected, and actually, I remember talking to you about a year and a half ago about these streaks and
right.
our enthusiasm about them. But until this year, until the results we released this week, basically what we had was we saw that something had happened. These dark streaks had formed. The surface was changing. And we thought it looked like a crime that water would commit, if you think of it as solving a mystery. What we have now is a fingerprint, a spectral fingerprint that only water could leave behind.
But you're not sure, as you say, where the water is coming from. It's coming and going.
That's exactly right, yes. So as you noted, there is some water in the atmosphere as vapor. There is ice in the subsurface, especially at higher latitudes. Some of these flows we see at low enough latitudes that you wouldn't expect ice to be there. So another possibility, and an exciting one, would be that there could be groundwater in aquifers that reaches the surface and flows outward occasionally in these events that we're seeing. But we have looked for aquifers with mm-hmm. subsurface penetrating radar, and we haven't detected them directly yet. So the water source does remain a mystery.
Mary Beth Wilhelm, one of the scientists at the press conference this week, speculated that the water might be coming from like dew. I mean, she seemed to say that we're even surprised by how much water vapor there is in the air.
Yeah, so the if you take a guess at how much water is involved in these flows, and it's a guess because we can see how long they are, we can see how wide they are. What we don't know is how deep the water extends. But if you take an educated guess about that, there is about just enough water vapor in the global atmosphere of Mars to provide all of these flows. But it's maybe a little challenging to see how you would wring all of that water out and concentrate it in the particular places these flows are occurring. But what I would say is that the dew could be a source of water that's being used at some locations, and maybe other locations are connected with groundwater. Maybe other locations are ice. It could be a little bit of each.
So what does it say to you as a scientist, and as someone who's involved in the space program, about the need now, if we know there's water there, we have, and that was pointed out at the conference this week, we know there's water there, we know we can make jet fuel, rocket fuel from what's on the planet, we can extract oxygen out of the CO2, we can plant crops there. Then, you know, you're just laying out a recipe for, hey, let's go there. You know?
We are, yeah, and I was fortunate to get to see the movie The Martian a few days early, and it's got me excited about those possibilities again too. There is a lot more that we would want to know with the Curiosity rover, which is not driving around one of these active flows at the moment, but exploring another part of Mars, has shown us that in its location, Gale Crater, there is nitrogen and carbon in the soils, and those are things that you would really have to have to grow anything there, unless you wanted to bring those kinds of nutrients with you. You could bring fertilizer, but you know, just like the water that we've fortunately now found in some places on Mars, we'd like the planet mm-hmm. to provide as many of these resources as possible, so we can take less with us.
The salts were described as perchlorates. Right?
Yes, that's right.
These are used here on Earth in some form of rocket fuel, aren't they? You could make
They
rocket
are sometimes, yes.
Yeah?
Yes. So if you heat them up in the presence of anything organic, then you will get, depending on how much is there, maybe an explosion. We actually do this sort of on purpose with the SAM experiment, the sample analysis at mm-hmm. Mars experiment on Curiosity, where we heat the soil samples gradually upward in temperature to 800 degrees Celsius at the end. And somewhere in there, you get to the point where the perchlorate that's in the soil is reacting with this mysterious source of carbon that we've also found there, and it releases oxygen. So you could heat Martian soil and get oxygen out of it that way. And it also makes the carbon combine with that oxygen, combine with the chlorine. So, yeah, this has practical uses, as you mentioned, rocket fuel. It has complicated implications for life. It's certainly reactive with organic matter, but usually not so at room temperature. So,
Would it destroy life if there was any there? Is it? No, would it snuff it out? Because I remember years ago when we were talking about the Viking mission, which tried to find life by, I think it was sprinkling some water on there and seeing what would happen to some of the soil. And Carl Sagan, among other people, thought very hard about it. And there was some thought that maybe we should relook at the results of that experiment in light of what we know now about what's going on there. Are people thinking about that?
Yes, yeah, that's exactly right. Viking experiments saw chlorine carbon compounds that at the time were thought to maybe be contaminants from Earth, from one of the cleaning fluids that was used on the spacecraft back on Earth. But we're now seeing similar things with Curiosity that, with the knowledge that Mars has perchlorates, make sense as the products you would get when you boil them all together. So I think if you sprinkle perchlorates on an organic rich soil and leave it at the cold normal surface conditions of Mars, that's basically a stable situation. It's just that we happen to like to look for life characterize the organic chemistry by heating the soil up to temperatures where they react with each other.
Mm-hmm. So where would you go from here? If you know, I'll give you the blank check question. I know this is a big blank check to go back to Mars and hundreds of billions of dollars. What would you do? What would give trace out for me a path that you would love to take?
So the The easy thing to do, and that we're going to do with upcoming robotic missions, is look at these flow features. We call them recurring slope lineae, by the way, RSL. Mm-hmm. Watch them at different times of day. So far, we've only seen them in the afternoon, which is the driest time of day on Mars. They might be more active in the morning. But if we really want to understand the implications for habitability, either by indigenous Martian life or utility for future human explorers, then I think we'll have to land at one of these sites at some point to be able to do that without risking contaminating the sites with life from the Earth. We would have to sterilize our spacecraft before we go. And then I think the kinds of things we'd want to look for are, like I was saying, nitrogen, carbon, the other sorts of nutrients that that life will need if we want to take it there and grow plants and, you know, maybe more complex biochemistry.
Are future missions going to be rejiggered to go to some of these places, perhaps, where the water is?
Well, the 2020 rover is NASA's next planned mission to the surface, and I think it's unlikely that it would be redesigned to actually go up and touch one of these, but it could look if it drove past one of them, look but don't touch, and avoid the risk of contamination that way. There is at least one of the sites, the potential landing sites that's been discussed for that mission, in the Valles Marineris Canyon system that should have some of these flow features on the horizon.
Wow, it seems like that is an interesting angle, because we might be bringing life with us. We don't want to go touch it and contaminate the surface, and then you don't know what's going to happen. Wow.
Now, of course, if humans go, it's a little bit hard to sterilize humans, so maybe all bets are off.
We should all have that problem, right? That should be the problem
exactly.
We worry about, is getting there and going. Dr. Ray, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us. James Ray, Assistant Professor of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at the Georgia Institute of Technology. We're going to take a break. We'll come back. We're turning from Mars Science Fact to Science Fiction. We're going to talk about Science Goes to the Movies with a review of The Martian. Stay with us. It's opening this week. We'll be right back after the break. This is Science Friday. I am Ira Plato.
The most spectacular science shocker ever filmed. Too real to be science fiction. Now, Science Fact.
Ah, that sound. Yes, we love it. It means it's time for Science Goes to the Movies. We asked scientists to think like film critics and weigh in on a science flick. And this week, as we say, we're talking about The Martian. Now, if this week's water news has you thinking, surviving on Mars wouldn't be so hard, right? Well, Hollywood is here to say, think a little more. Think again. The Martian stars Matt Damon as an astronaut stranded on the red planet. It's based on a book by the same name. And a dust storm and a botched evacuation separate astronaut Mark Watney from his NASA crew, leaving him solo on the Martian surface. Just how bad is Mark's situation? Cue the dramatic music.
I have no way to contact NASA or my crewmates. But even if I could, it would take 4 years for another manned mission to reach me. And I'm in a hab designed to last 31 days. So, in the face of overwhelming odds, I'm left with only one option. I'm going to have to science the out of this.
Yes, you heard that right. In The Martian, getting back home means getting the science right. And here to talk about the science and the movie are our two scientist film critics. Don Pettit, NASA astronaut. He joins us from Johnson Space Center in Houston. Welcome back to Science Friday, Don.
It's always a pleasure to be here, Ira.
Thank you. Also welcoming back is Babak Ferdowsi. He is a Europa Clipper mission engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, a veteran of the Curiosity rover mission on Mars, and he joins us from a JPL in Pasadena. Welcome back, Mohawk Man.
Glad to be back.
Let's get right into this. Don, let's get some of your first impressions. Don, does The Martian get two thumbs up?
Well, I like to say that this movie can stand on its own, even under Martian gravity.
Why? You have to expound
That's
a little
cheating.
More on that. Was good. Good quote, Don. What do you mean by that?
Well, first off, I don't think you should get hung up on any of the incorrect, geeky details that you might happen to see. It's a wonderful story. You need to sit back and enjoy the story. And you have to remember that Hollywood is about telling stories, particularly stories that we can project ourselves into. So watch the movie, enjoy it, and start thinking about what would I do if I was there instead of Mark Watney.
You know, and it's interesting because this was not an anti-government film, and that or NASA can't do anything right, or the astronauts are trying to hurt one another. It was just the opposite of all of that.
Yeah, it was. And one of the things I loved about this movie was that you didn't see a government conspiracy. You didn't see greedy industrialists trying to figure out how to wield power. There was not even the evil astronaut. There was no Dr. Smith from Lost in Space or Hal or even Dr. Mann, the evil Dr. Mann from Interstellar.
Mm-hmm. Bobak, how about you? Like it as much?
I loved it, honestly. I think it's a tribute to engineering and the ingenuity of people. It's all about applying science. This guy has a limited skill set, not that limited, obviously, when you watch the movie, but he finds all sorts of clever ways of overcoming the odds. And Mars plays a pretty good villain in the movie.
Yeah. And you saw last night with a bunch of JPL folks?
We did. A bunch of, Mars mission folks. I think we had a handful of rover drivers, former flight directors, you name it. So it's about 40 or 50 of us that rented out a theater altogether.
Don, how, and I'll ask both of you, how realistic did it portray how real engineers think about problems?
I liked the way it showed how engineers think. You're always doing calculations. You're looking, particularly if you're in a frontier, you're looking at the resources you have and the rates at which you are consuming them. And then you are doing a little bit of math in public and trying to figure out what's going to kill you first. And this book, the book showed this, the movie showed this. It's how the quintessential engineer thinks in order to stay alive in the frontier.
I thought it was interesting the way he kept saying, all right, let's not go too far to the end of the problem. Let's think of what's important for the next 5 minutes, solve that in the next 5 minutes, and that sort of progression. Bobak, is that how the engineers in real life do it?
It's a little bit of both. You got to think long term, and there's definitely parts of the movie where he talks about how to plan for the long trip ahead, but otherwise, that's totally right. We try to break it down into small problems that we can solve one at a time, and not overwhelming. Mm-hmm. You think about a mission like Curiosity or a human mission to Mars. It's thousands of small steps, not just one big one.
No matter what happened, he never lost his optimism. He said, "I'm going to get out of here." Is that realistic? The way astronauts think?
I think it is. It's certainly the way I think, and I could say, on experience from ISS, you could have the machine that makes your oxygen break down. And it isn't like, oh my gosh, we're all going to die. It's you got a few weeks to figure out how to get it fixed, and you're going to be working with people from the ground in order to get it fixed. Now, what can happen and has happened on station is when the toilet breaks. Now that's serious. All work stops.
Then you have to be a real MacGyver.
Yeah, I mean, you can run out of, you could, the oxygen machine could break down, the CO2 scrubber could break down, and you got a while to fix it. But the toilet breaks down, all work stops.
Yeah, there was a little bit of that in the film, too. We talked with the Martian author Andy Weir last year when the book version of The Martian came out, and Andy explained how he used a crowdsourcing to get the science right.
When I originally posted it, it was just a serial fiction story that I was posting to my website. I didn't realize it would become a published book someday, and so I published each chapter one at a time, and I got a lot of feedback from readers saying, like, oh, you got this wrong, or oh, the math on this is wrong, mm-hmm. That's helpful, or you misunderstood how the chemistry works on this thing, here's how it would properly work. And so I got to fix those problems. And so by the time the book was done, it was really very accurate.
Hmm. Bobak, I have to ask you to take off your science fan hat and put on your science critic hat. And tell us, where do you think were there any big errors in the movie?
I think probably the biggest error, it kind of kicks off the movie, so it's not a spoiler. It's the dust storm that's about to tip over their ascent vehicle. They return to the Hermes MAV, as they call it, Mars ascent vehicle. And, you know, the wind forces on Mars, they're just not that big. The speeds get pretty high, but just because the atmospheric density is so low, it doesn't do much. So it's kind of, the difference would be like a linebacker running at me versus a small kitten running at me at full speed. You know, I can take a kitten. I don't think I can take a linebacker.
Hmm. Could they have stranded Mark on Mars without cheating with the science, without having to create such a big storm that would not exist? How would you have written that scene?
I think I would have gone with radiation. It's the one subject that's not talked about a lot in the movie, and it's a real challenge for the human missions to Mars. It's even a challenge for our robotic missions. Radiation can upset computers and cause resets and cause memory damage and things like that. And we see that damage over time on our missions, too. So, you could have had a kind of a solar flare or something and with X-ray radiation heading towards Mars, and they would have had to evacuate similarly.
Don, what would your fertile imagination have come up with?
For the dust storm?
Instead of the dust storm, what could have kept him on the planet?
I'd have to go with the radiation just because that could be something that could require an abort really quickly. And if you don't happen to be in the right place at the right time, you might be like missing the school bus in the morning.
Our number, 844-724-8255 is our number, 844-SCI-TALK. You can also give us some questions at SCI-FRI, S-C-I-F-R-I. Of course, they could have all been trying to leave the planet and just crash land back and only one survive. Just as simple. Something like that.
Well, that was like this movie I saw back as a kid, the Robinson Crusoe on Mars, where the spacecraft crashed and there was only one survivor.
And any similarities to that one?
Gosh, it's been so long, I can't remember. There were aliens in that movie, so it got a little wild at the end.
Yes, I remember those Martian movies. Babak, now that we know about the liquid water on Mars, and we just went through the NASA talking about finding it, would that have changed the story in your mind at all? Would Mark Watney have been able to use that water that we know exists there now?
The thing with water is it's definitely usable. In fact, you can use it to make propellant and you can use it to, for drinking and other things. The water on Mars, as Dr. Ray just mentioned, it's not exactly, ready to drink as it is. So it definitely takes some work. In fact, Andy mentioned it even in some interviews, Andy Weir, the author. And I think he thought he would use it actually against Mark Watney. He was suggesting that, he might drive near it and instead go down a slope that he wasn't intending to go down. So I think, knowing the plot line, it's anything that can go wrong kind of does go wrong. And in this case, probably the water would have done the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Now, Donna, I know you're a gardening geek. I am a fellow gardening geek, so I'm going to talk to you gardener to gardener. I want you to explain how Mark Watney was able to use just a few potatoes NASA gave the crew for their Thanksgiving meal to solve his food shortage. Did you find that believable?
Yes and no. I raised potatoes in my garden, and I just did my fall planting last weekend, and I have three different kinds of potatoes growing. But what NASA does with their food is they sanitize and plasticize and vacuumize and make it so that it can withstand arduous journeys to space and last a long time. And I kind of have a feeling those poor old potatoes would have been in a state where they would not sprout. But for the sake of the movie, I thought it was a wonderful idea to use the potatoes. NASA's done a lot of research on growing potatoes in space, specifically for food. And I bet you Andy Weir has seen some of those papers that NASA's written about the wholesome nature of potatoes in space.
But he didn't plant potatoes from seeds. He actually cut them up like we did as kids, with the eye sticking out, and plant them in the ground.
Yes.
Yeah, but that doesn't work anymore, Ira, because if you take potatoes from the grocery store, they are treated with hormones now to keep them from sprouting, because people don't like to look in their pantry and see all these sprouts coming out of their potatoes. And if you've noticed, that doesn't happen anymore, specifically because they're treated that way. And you need to get seed potatoes if you want to garden these days.
Yeah, that's not going to work anymore like it did. But he did fertilize them with his own, the excrement from the crew. Would that work?
That would be the way I would head. You have the Martian soil. You've got what you could get from your porta potty, and you have the water that he made, and assuming you could cut the potatoes up, and one potato will have a lot of eyes in it, so you could, in concept, get lots of plants from just one potato. So I think he did everything right from the point of view of trying to get these seeds growing.
This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Ira Flatow, talking with Don Pettit and Babak Ferdowsi about Mars and about the new film, The Martian, that's opening this week. And I'll tell you, I'm along with you guys. I love that film. And I loved it for a lot of different levels. And one being that it really captured the joy of space exploration. There's a scene in there, you know, I'm not giving anything away, but, you know, about the celebrating in Times Square about a mission in space that reminded me of when Neil Armstrong walked on the moon the night we all did that. I mean, that really did happen. People screaming and jumping out in the streets. We haven't seen that at all. Babak, you're probably not old enough to remember that.
I'm not, but I definitely remember even the night of Curiosity's landing and people being in Times Square. Certainly not the same numbers, I'm sure, as like Apollo and hopefully a Mars mission in the future. But it's definitely an amazing sense. And I did feel that kind of that lump in my throat, that emotional kind of connection to the you know, being part of the world and watching this journey. And I love the sense that the kind of the world rallied around Mark Watney. I think that was a wonderful sentiment.
You'd love to see that, some sort of celebration like that again, I'll bet.
I would love to see it really for the first time.
Yeah. I mean, there's a person, people on Mars. Well, maybe that would happen. Let me ask you, as a former member of the Curiosity team, you know Mars. Did the Mars in the movie look like the Mars that you knew?
It definitely, you know, a lot of it does. A lot of it, certainly the aerial shots and things like that look a lot more like it. The steep canyon walls and things like that, there are places like that on Mars. We certainly haven't landed anywhere near them yet because our landing kind of area is so much bigger. We want to land in nice, big, flat, smooth places where possible. But in the future, I would imagine we would like to land near kind of those features. That's where you see a lot of exposed history of Mars. You might see, you know, sedimentary layers and things like that. So that could be a good place for future missions. But right now, we haven't been able to experience it with our robotic explorers yet.
I want to play a clip from the movie that really shows what kind of guy Mark Watney is. And first, you're going to hear the Mars mission director of NASA, and then you're going to hear Mark up on Mars.
He's 50 million miles away from home. He thinks he's totally alone. He thinks we gave up on him. I mean, what does that do to a man psychologically? What the hell is he thinking right now?
I'm definitely gonna die up here if I have to listen to any more god-awful disco music.
My God, Commander Lewis, couldn't you have packed anything from this century?
My favorite music. What's interesting about that is he's facing death, and he's sort of, the astronaut is sort of have a goofy sense of humor. He doesn't spend his time moping around about a situation. Does that ring true for you, Don?
Yes, Ira, I could, that scene describes numerous times with being on space station, not necessarily in a life and death situation, but sort of a disconnect between what the ground may be thinking and discussing versus what's going on in this orbital frontier.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever think, watching the movie, I know this astronaut's in a terrible situation, he's probably going to die up there, but doesn't that look like fun?
Well, exploring is thrilling. And it's a lot of work. You have a mission. It's something that's serious, and you have to take it serious. And so there's that aspect of exploring. And when you are exploring, you don't ever wish for maladies. You don't want to be a hero. You want everything to be nominal. But if you are put in a situation where things go off nominal, first you use your training. And then when you outrun what your training provides you, then you just have to go with what your background, skills, and knowledge happens to be.
All right, we're going to take a break and talk lots more about The Martian with Don Pettit, NASA astronaut at Johnson Space Center. Babak Ferdowsi is a Europa Clipper mission engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. And our number, yes, we'd like to hear from you, 844-724-8255. We're also going to talk about growing plants on Mars or anywhere else in space. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, it's our Science Goes to the Movies segment. We're talking about the new space flick, The Martian, the tale of an astronaut stranded Robinson Crusoe style on the red planet. And joining me to help separate science, fact, and fiction and schmooze about the film are two scientist film critics, Don Pettit, NASA astronaut. He joins us from the Johnson Space Center in Houston. Babak Ferdowsi is a Europa Clipper mission engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. Our number is 844-724-8255. We've had some tweets come in while we're away, especially Don talking about potatoes. Tom Swiss says, my organic potatoes still sprout. I've even replanted them. Maybe NASA should make sure to go organic. And then another person, Jamie Patton, says, my non-organic potatoes from the grocery store still sprout all the time. So maybe it's the luck of the potato draw about which potatoes.
Maybe it has something to do with what we have in the grocery stores here at Houston. But I do know that the potatoes here don't sprout. They just like to sit there in the dirt and eventually rot. But the seed potatoes work really well.
All right, let's go to the phones. Let's see if we can get a phone call in. Carrie from Stonington, Connecticut. Hi there. Hey.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to, first of all, thank your guests for their service. Really noble profession. And also, my husband is a commander of a nuclear submarine, which is very similar to a space shuttle. I gave him the book, The Martian, for his deployment, and I'm super excited to see the movie when he gets home. But I wondered if your guests had any sort of educated guess at what the timeline would be before we get the first people out to Mars, if we're able to do that.
Don, Bob, you want to take a...
I'll let Bobic answer that.
Sure, I mean... So NASA has a plan to basically put people on Mars in the 2030s. There's a couple of architectures kind of floating out there, but they all kind of involve incremental steps of developing technologies. In fact, you see a lot of the technologies in the movie. You see the Hermes spacecraft, the transfer spacecraft between Mars and Earth kind of looks like the space station bits and pieces. They use ion thrust, which we definitely, you know, we use on our robotic missions, but we're planning on using for human-rated missions in the future. And some of the architectures involve, you know, humans in orbit in 2033, where they could telerobotically kind of operate, so they would have robots on the surface. Unlike Curiosity, they don't have to wait for the time delay. They can just kind of drive them around. And then in 2039, possibly setting foot on Mars.
But there really is no money allocated for a big kind of spaceship and whatever and the hardware that would be needed to go to Mars right now. I mean, get there right now, but right now the money's not there. Would that be fair to say, Don?
Yeah, that's one of the problems with a lot of these exploration missions is we could do the engineering and say that here's how we want to design our vehicle, and then we have to sit back and say, send money, and because it takes money to actually cut the metal and build these spaceships and fly them, and that seems to be what we're short of.
Do you think that a film like this, I mean, has there been any, you know, hubbub going on about maybe Congress might get interested by the popularity of a film like this? Can it make a change, you think? Possibly? No?
Well, I mean, it's hard to say politically, obviously, but I definitely think it can make a change in terms of how young people kind of grow up perceiving NASA and exploration and maybe the value of doing it and being excited about doing it and becoming engineers. So I think it still helps even at that level, you know, the types of kids who will grow up and come up with creative ways of solving some of the challenges. I mean, we can engineer a lot of it, but it's still not easy even for us. And so I think in that level, it could be very valuable for the future of Mars exploration. And the kids who are going to watch it today are going to be the kids, hopefully, who actually get to go be the first people on Mars.
But they might also be watching it in a different country that might be getting there first on Mars. Or they might not be working for the government. They might be working for a private rocket. You know, Elon Musk talks about going to Mars.
Yeah. Well, all of that is good for my perspective. And what I like to see is when I go out to schools and talk to students from all grade levels, there's no shortage of the younger generation that want to take my job when I'm sitting in a rocking chair.
Now, we have had a lot of great space movies lately. We've had Gravity. We've had Interstellar. How would you both rate The Martian? Where would it fit in this space movie pantheon?
Well, this has been my favorite so far, I think, of kind of that recent batch of space movies, just because it's optimistic enough about the future, but it as kind of Don mentioned earlier, there's a lot in there that you can immediately relate to. It is, you know, things that you see could happen in the next, you know, dozen years, 20 years or so. And I really like that. You could imagine yourself in that situation. You could kind of it taps into that also, as I think I mentioned, that survival instinct. You know, what would you do in that position? So to me, it was the best, and because of, you know, it also it kind of represents JPL in a very positive, you know, like fun way. So I might be a little biased.
Bob, no, Don, you agree? It's where would you fit?
Yeah, I agree 100%. It's a wholesome story about humans working together as a techno team, both on and off the planet, to explore a frontier. And it, like we mentioned earlier, there's no evil astronaut. There's no government conspiracy. There's not even a love interest. I mean, it's just wholesome working together in an environment where human beings were not equipped to go except with technology, and we're expanding the frontier at both on Earth and on Mars. And well, so I loved it from that point of view.
One of the interesting facts I found out about it is that there's nothing in this film that could not be made today. There's no breakthrough in technology that's really required to create any of these things that you saw in the movie. Would that be fair, Don?
Yeah, I would say yes, that would be fair. It doesn't require discovering a wormhole that you could fly a spaceship through or anything like that. It's just stuff that you could look at and identify with.
Except the radiation problem, which we haven't really figured that out quite yet. I want to thank you both for it. This has been a lot of fun. Thank you guys for taking time to be with us today. And
thank you.
You're welcome. We'll have you back for the next film. Don Pettit, a NASA astronaut based at the Johnson Space Flight Center. Babak Ferdowsi, Europa Clipper mission engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena. We aren't quite up to farming potatoes on Mars like Mark Watney did in The Martian. No Martian French fries anytime soon. But scientists are working to understand how do plants grow in space. And that's the subject of our latest macroscope video up on sciencefriday.com. And here to talk about it is science documentary producer Emily Driscoll. Welcome back, Emily.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And we're going to ask astronaut film critic Don Pettit to stick around with us a little longer. He's had some hands-on space gardening experience we're going to talk about. So thanks for hanging out with us a little bit more, Don.
My pleasure. I could talk about growing plants in space for hours, and I'm looking at the time ticking away. I think you'll probably have to bring the hook out.
Well, we'll just bring you back for another segment. That's all. Emily, you met some scientists who were trying to grow A weed. Yes. Not potatoes, a weed.
Exactly. Dr. Annalisa Paul and Dr. Robert Furl at the University of Florida Gainesville Space Plants Lab, they're growing this humble weed, which, you know, could be called crackworts. You know, you might see them when you're walking down the sidewalk, peering through cracks in the sidewalk. But the scientific name is Arabidopsis. Mm-hmm. And they choose that plant because it's kind of like a main test subject for studying plants in the way that a mouse or fruit fly would be for other scientists.
Well, the film, what's interesting about the film right off the bat is the point that's made is that the plants know when they're in space.
They do. They even know when they're in a jet plane at 30,000 feet. They're very sensitive to these changes in the atmosphere and pressure, and they don't have brains, as they say, as Dr. Furl says in the film, but they can sense it in their metabolism, and they change what's happening in their genes to deal with what's happening in mm-hmm. zero G or even in 30,000 feet.
Don, I know when you were up at the space station, you had an unofficial gardening project going there.
I did, and its purpose was just to make the space equivalent of a potted plant in a kitchen window. No resources from station, no electricity, no fans, no computer, a data transfer or control. It was just to be a small splash of green in a sea of machinery.
And what plants did you grow up there?
Well, I grew three plants on my last mission. I grew space zucchini. And then he had his buddy, space broccoli. And then there was space sunflower.
Hmm. And Emily, that's not quite what was being shown in your film. But your film did show some quite interesting results from the and how the roots were growing.
Exactly.
So
the scientists sent up the plants as seeds, so they would spend their entire life at the International Space Station with never having been around gravity. And they put the plants in these clear square cassettes, and some were closer to a light source than others, so the light was different. And so what they found is that the plants that were in the cassettes farther from the light, they started to grow down the plate, but then they did this slant to the left, which is called skewing. So that was really surprising to them because they thought that skewing was a result of gravity. So something else was guiding it, and it was probably light, but it also could be different things like moisture or nutrients.
So they had guesses for what they would do with it. They were wrong about
exactly
what the roots would do. Don, did you notice weird things with the roots of your plants?
I did. The plants, if they were in sort of a environment where the humidity was constant in all directions, they would grow up in the same direction as the stem. They'd grow out in various directions, and sometimes I'd have to sort of poke the roots back down into the root container because they were growing out where the stem and the leaves were supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Emily, could the space plant research you're talking about, do you think it could help Mars explorers?
Yes, they're studying putting these plants in these extreme situations to understand how plants grow in zero gravity and potentially Mars. And they're even working in the hot and Canadian high Arctic where they could potentially program plants to activate. So they could lie dormant and then they could send them ahead of time. So when astronauts actually get to Mars, they could activate them so the plants would be growing already when they arrive.
They'd have food when they get there.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Don Pettit and Emily Driscoll. Emily's got the video. It's our video up there on the macroscope about the plants growing in zero G. Don, did you see big differences between your space plants and your plants on Earth? I know your space sunflower looked a little bit funny.
Yes, I learned a lot from space sunflower. And what I learned is that plants are like people. They are intrinsically lazy, and they only put out as much effort as the environment requires. So here I had this sunflower, and he was a meter and a half long, and his stalk was maybe an eighth of an inch thick, and it was this little spindly thing that was all sinuous and bent and warped, and it only put out enough stalk material
to make the vascular bundles to conduct the juices from the root ball up to the growing machinery. And if you look at a sunflower of similar size on Earth, it might have a stalk a half inch in diameter, and it's straight as an arrow. And it needs that in order to deal with gravity and get its leaves up above all the other weeds like Arabidopsis or something that might be trying to choke it out.
Emily, anything we can learn from space for Earth? Applying stuff?
Yes, just understanding plant biology in general is really important, but also to understand how plants can grow in extreme conditions here on Earth. Because of climate change and the population explosion, we're going to need to learn how to do that.
Don, did your sunflower actually bloom up there in space?
Yeah, sunflower bloomed and made seeds, and the seeds remained on space station for another few months, and they actually rode down on one of the SpaceX capsules. And then I planted them, and I've got like the third generation space sunflower growing in my backyard.
So you have the only sunflower seeds ever germinated on Earth that came from space.
You know, I hadn't quite thought about it that way, but now I've got sunflowers in my backyard that their great-great-grandfather sunflower was an astro sunflower.
How did the broccoli do? As good? As well?
Broccoli, I did manage to get a little piece of broccoli down alive, and broccoli, actually space broccoli, and it's a perennial, so it's still growing. And space broccoli's growing growing in my backyard, but unfortunately last weekend I was mowing the lawn and I got a little close and I clipped him, and I'm hoping he can recover from that.
You need a little museum back there now, Don. A little garden, space garden. You have the only plants that were started in space. We need a tourist attraction.
Well, you know, I'm sure there are other plants that have been grown for bona fide scientific experiments, and I know that they are brought down to Earth, and I don't know what kind of tortures they've been subjected to in terms of scientific study. So that might be an interesting thing to find out.
All right, that's cool. We learn something new every week here on Science Right. Emily, thank you very much. Emily Driscoll, documentary producer. Don Pettit, NASA astronaut based at Johnson in Houston. You're always welcome, Don, to talk, gardening. We'll have you back for our annual gardening show.
Okay, we could talk about sweet potatoes next time.
I'm writing it down. And you can watch our Plants in Space. That's our new macroscope video at sciencefriday.com. If you want to see what Don Pettit's space sunflower looks like, we've got the pics. Go to sciencefriday.com/spaceplants. And if you want more Mars, we've got an interview with NASA's Dava Newman about when she thinks we'll see humans on the red planet and be Earth independent. That's at sciencefriday.com/NASA on Mars. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music, and our thanks to our production partners at the studios of the City University of New York. As I say, go to our website. We've got all kinds of Mars stuff up there this week. Also, the Plants in Space Macroscope video by Emily Driscoll is up there. Stuff to keep you busy for the rest of the weekend. Have a great week. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.